One of the reasons that I research in the area of adolescence and youth is that I would tell you if I had a chance that even being older and wiser now and knowing what I know now, I would not want to relive my teenage years. Not for love nor money would I want to go back through those years. How many other people here feel that way? Fair few of you. Who feels differently? Who'd very happily? There's a few of you, a few brave souls. And we probably should do some research on those of you who would happily relive those years, but I've spent my time doing research, looking more at what goes wrong during this particular point in time. And I'm going to talk to you today about why it is, some of the reasons why many of us wouldn't want to relive those years, and what we can do today to help young people to transit this particularly vulnerable part of their lives. But it is certainly the case that young people are uniquely vulnerable to mental health problems and to this being a period that isn't always ideal for them. Across the lifespan, we know that most mental health problems first emerge in this period over adolescence, from sort of puberty through to early adulthood. The only mental disorders that start earlier in life are behavioural disorders. Then in childhood we start to see anxiety disorders emerging, and then throughout the teenage years and into early adulthood, all the mental health problems tend to have their first incidence. The only thing we have to look forward to later on in life in terms of mental disorder is dementia, which we get right at the other end of the lifespan. But this is one in four young people are likely to experience at any given time, any 12-month period, a mental health problem. This is shown up in this graph, which many of you may have seen, which looks at the burden of disease across the lifespan. And you can see in this sort of yellowy hump here, this is the increase in mental health problems and mental disorders, which starts to occur just in the beginning of the teen years, then peaks about 20, and then begins to drop off again towards over the 20s. But the health problem for teenagers and people in early adulthood are mental disorders. We now have good data showing us that about half of all mental disorders start before the age of 14, and three quarters of them before the age of 25. Most later presentations tend to either have been unnoticed presentations that occurred earlier or their relapses. We even have data now showing us that by age 21, about half of young people will have experienced a clinically relevant mental health problem, which shows that this really is the health issue that we need to be addressing for young people and finding ways to help young people transit through this period moving into adulthood without these problems ending up having such serious consequences for their adult life. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether mental disorders are increasing. It's quite difficult to look at data and see, are things getting worse? We do probably have pretty good data showing that psychological distress is definitely increasing in young people these days. But if it is the case that we have more mental health problems, more psychological distress, why might that be? And there are a number of reasons, and many different people posit different reasons for this. But one thing that we do know has happened is that things tend to start to really accelerate in terms of mental health problem with the onset of puberty. And one of the things that's occurred over the last 30 or so years is that puberty is occurring earlier, and we have an extended period where we keep young people in what we call adolescence. So it's completely normal range for girls for puberty to occur at 9. That's normal. Not early, that's within the normal range. And if you think about that, Think about how many primary schools are actually very well set up for girls and young women to be coping with these sorts of issues when they're in years 4, 5 and 6. There's a study, a large study was undertaken in the late 90s in the United States that showed that in that study that 50% of the African American girls and 15% of the Caucasian girls had significant breast development at the age of 8. So we are having a much earlier biological maturity occurring. There are lots of reasons people postulate this, whether it's the hormones we put in chickens. With my daughters, I blame having them drink soy milk rather than drinking ordinary milk. But for whatever reason, and there are some quite well-reasoned evaluations of this, we are having puberty. The physiological and the sexual maturity of people start earlier. On the other side of that, though, we've extended the period of time where people are more dependent, and we've extended adolescence. And we now often, it's not considered unusual to even think of adolescent-type behaviours extending through to about the age of 30. So people are still at school, they're still at home, they haven't started their own family, we're delaying marriage, we're delaying having children, we're keeping people in education longer. So we have this 20-year period of adolescence now where people can be, you know, haven't taken on the yokes of adulthood and are in this this kind of in-between zone. People also talk about now, and this is something that's especially occurred over about, and or accelerated again over the last 10 years, this has created a period of where there's a super peer effect that occurs. We have this extended period where young people are involved with their peers, not taking on adult roles. Social media, of course, then has really created a 24/7 online super peer group that is having a marked influence on how young people's peer relationships, their social relationships. So if you start thinking about, you know, some really qualitatively different things have happened to young people in the last 20 or 30 years with this extended adolescence and now this online super peer influence affecting how young people behave and making them more vulnerable to peer influences and what's happening in that space. So this has been sort of characterised as being that we've got this growing biological and psychological mismatch whereby we've created this extended period of adolescence, which may be contributing to young people having more psychological distress, certainly being more vulnerable to many of the influences that we know that impact on people's well-being. Another thing that has changed, and you'll hear a bit more with Mike Nagel's presentation later this morning, we know a great deal more now about the adolescent brain and what happens in terms of brain maturity. We used to think that around about puberty, that the brain developed and with age of 12 or thereabouts, that young people had a developed adult brain. So we would expect them to think and behave as adults do. We know now that that is not the case and that the brain goes through substantial changes in adolescence. And this is a period of considerable brain activity. We also know that the brain matures from the back forward and the inside out. And the very last part of the brain to fully mature are the prefrontal cortex. This is the part of the brain that makes you have consequential thinking, that makes you the boring, rational adult who says, no, don't do that because this is what will happen. This part of the brain doesn't mature now till we understand till the mid-20s, even into the late 20s. So while adolescents and teenagers can appear to be perfectly rational human beings, they're actually not. And the best argument I have with my own children, who are all in this age group, I tell them that no, they can't make that decision because their brain isn't mature enough yet to be able to make it. So those of us who are older and wiser need to provide some guidance. Obviously, we need to recognise young people's maturity and what's happening with them. But with our, this sort of understanding of what's happening with the brain, it does mean that we do need to be aware that young people are still vulnerable to particular things. They're still being driven a bit more by their amygdala, so they're more emotionally aroused. They're more driven by their emotions, more easily upset by things that we have learned to rationalise more as we get older. They're also uniquely vulnerable to their peers. So high arousal and the presence of peers are things that make young people at risk. Young people at risk of undertaking risky behaviours, behaving in ways that they wouldn't rationally do if you asked them at another time. They'd say, no, you shouldn't do that. But put them in those conditions and they do tend to behave in risky ways. And this can also make them more vulnerable to mental health problems. One other thing I'd like to just say about the adolescent brain too, which I think is something important for those of us who work with young people to take on board, is that a significant period of pruning goes on during adolescence. And what that means with the brain is what a young person doesn't use, those neurons start to become pruned off. The neurons that are used become strengthened. So through a process called myelinization, those neuronal branches become strengthened and they become hardwired. So this means young people who, and very often at around about puberty and at around about high school, they start to give up many of the things that they enjoyed and that they would happily do when they were in primary school. So they'll give up sport, they'll give up playing the piano, they'll give up dance. Giving these things up over this period of time can mean those skills are pretty much lost forever. Those branches of the brain then become pruned, become cut off because they're not being used. This makes it very hard then when you're 30 and you decide, oh, I really wish I had learned to play the guitar, to pick up those skills and bring them back. The other thing is it means that those types of neuronal pathways that are being used become strengthened. So young people who are anxious, self-conscious, start to develop real negative self-talk patterns. These start to become hardwired. So this is the reason and one of the major reasons why we need to intervene softly and early to help young people not to develop these negative soundtracks for their lives, which can be laid down in adolescence so that we don't have to then, through therapy later on, try to undo what has started to be hardwired in terms of their neuronal patterns. When I tell you statistics like, half of all young adults before the age of 21 will have experienced a clinically relevant mental health problem, you can start to become concerned. Well, how do I know what's normal, what's not normal? When should I be worried? If it's so common, should we just expect it? How do we sort through what is just going through the normal challenges of being a teenager and what is something significant that maybe I as a teacher or someone working with young people should be responsive to? And we're starting to get some good resources to help through these. Jane Burns with the CRC would have talked through a whole range of resources that the CRC is developing. We have lots of good websites, and also an excellent book is Michael Carr Gregg's book, When to Really Worry, which is a great resource for parents, but also for teachers and others working with young people that goes through what are the signs and symptoms of different types of problems, how might you react to them. But knowing some of the things that really matter to young people is also important to know when we might intervene. A crisis for a young person doesn't necessarily mean that they're crying and hysterical in a corner. that's not the way you're necessarily going to recognise that a young person really needs help. And we need to think back to the things that really matter to young people. And while these types of issues that I have up here matter to all of us, they are quite critical and are more important for people who are teenagers. These are more acutely worrying to teenagers because of how their brain and their social relationships are set up. Those of us who have lived a bit longer, got a bit older and wiser, we've survived a few relationship breakups. We know it's not going to be the end of the world. We've learned to be more self-sufficient. We have developed a greater repertoire of coping. We know that things will get better, things will change, we will survive. Young people, and if you can remember thinking back to what it was like when you were a teenager, things are really critical. People don't think they're going to get through it. They're living in the here and now, emotionally aroused, and particularly things related to their peers and their peer relationships become critical for them. And we shouldn't underestimate how important things that we might think then are not all that relevant are. So relationship breakups mean a great deal to young people. Being included with their peers and consequently, therefore, any sort of bullying and any kind of social isolation are really things that matter a great deal to young people and make them vulnerable to being upset. Their families are very important to them, even though it might not seem that way. They are acutely attuned to family conflict. And they get very stressed by exams, by school, and, you know, we will say to them, it's just another exam, you'll be fine, you'll just get through it. And again, Mike will talk to you a bit about some of these issues. They are extremely stressed by some of these issues. The other things that are acutely important to youth are body image and their developing sexuality. And these are issues that can make them particularly vulnerable to mental health crises. So what are some of the things that you might notice in your roles? And I know most of you, many of you, how many of you here are teachers? So there's quite a lot of teachers. The rest of you work in different roles with young people as youth workers, community workers, various types of roles where you are directly in contact with young people. And many of you will have very important role in young people's lives. And the literature calls your roles often gatekeepers, which is not a very good term. But it means that you often have trusted relationships with young people. You spend a lot of time with them. You might not be, you know, a mental health professional, but you're somebody that young people may open up to, that you will see what's going on in their lives. So some of the things that you might notice that would indicate that something's going not quite right and might indicate a mental health problem are these types of issues. So obviously truancy is one of the things that would happen in schools. Truancy is always a sign that something is not quite right in a young person's life and would be an indicator that you might want to investigate further. Social withdrawal is an indication. Young people, by their very nature, should be very engaged with their peers. So if they start to withdraw from their peers and from others in their social world and stop doing activities they used to enjoy, these are signs that something might not be quite right. Lack of self-care can be an indicator, although here you have to be a little bit careful. Girls will tend to increase their self-care in teenagers, but boys can sometimes go the other way. I have a 16-year-old son. He does spend a lot of time in the shower. I'm not entirely sure what he does in there, though, because he can come out just as stinky as he went in. So you've got to be a little bit care about the self-care. Self-harm can be something that you do see, and self-harm's a very clear sign that a young person is having trouble coping, that they haven't developed a coping repertoire for what they're going through. Changes in sleep, changes in eating, Also being aware of what's happening in young people's lives. Are there incidents, particularly incidents around their peers and relationships? These are things that they're acutely attuned to and they are vulnerable to. Also, if they're engaging in risky behaviours, this will be a sign that things may not be quite right, and if there are things happening in their family. Families are very important to young people, and if they have family risk factors, they're going to be more vulnerable to mental health problems. But then the question is, should you intervene? I would argue that in Australia, we probably have a culture where we tend not to intervene. We don't like busybodies, we don't like dobbers, we don't like whistleblowers. We, you know, think you should just get on with your own life and keep your nose out of other people's business. We also have a strong sense with young people, which I totally agree with, that we shouldn't pathologise being a teenager and some of the issues that they're going through. And also a bit of a sense, it's just teenage angst, they'll grow out of it, they'll be fine. I'd like to put to you that in this, for the reasons I'll go through now, we really do have an obligation to intervene for young people in appropriate ways to help them through this period, and that those of us who work closely with them and have trusted relationships with them, this is something that we should be highly vigilant about. And one of the main reasons is that despite the high levels of distress that young people might be experiencing, they don't seek professional help. So we have good data showing that only about less than a third of young women seek help when they have a mental disorder, and this is much less for young men. So in our national data, only 13% of the young men, 16 to 24, had sought help when they had been experiencing mental disorder. In work that I've done in the schools looking at help seeking over the high school years, I looked at some large samples of young people and found that by year 10, not one single boy with symptoms of depression was reaching out for help from any professional service. So there are some things that happen across the high school years in terms of help seeking that really change the nature and mean that the older a teenager, the less likely they are to reach out for help. And what we find is, primary school students and primary school age kids do tend to reach out to help and ask for help, particularly from their parents and very often the mother, but can be both the mother and father. But something happens over the high school years, and during this period we find that both boys and girls reduce their level of seeking help from their parents. And if you think about this, this makes sense. They're becoming independent young people. They want to stand on their own two feet. They have to individuate from their family. So it makes sense that they start to be less likely to confide in their parents, although parents still remain the main source of seeking help. But what girls do to compensate for this is they increase their help seeking from their friends. And many of you who work in schools will know there's nothing like girls getting upset for one of their friends, and they get like bees in a bottle. They actually escalate each other's distress, and they sometimes come en masse to their favourite teacher or the school counsellor, greatly disturbed about something that's happened in one of their friends' lives. Boys don't do that though. Boys learn over the high school years to not share these issues with their friends, and they increasingly come to keep things in and just rely on themselves. And this can make boys particularly vulnerable. I guess the thing we're most worried about in terms of mental health crises is suicide. That boys, if they bottle things up, if they aren't telling anybody, that we are particularly concerned about their risk of suicide. In some of the work I've done, these are the sorts of barriers that young people say about why they don't seek help, and particularly why they don't seek professional help. And the first one, that they, you know, you shouldn't need help, you should rely on yourselves. This again relates very much to they want to become independent, they want to be able to stand on their own two feet, they want to be autonomous. But this feeds into the fact that you shouldn't reach out for help. You should be able to handle things yourself. Strongly related to this is a belief that seeking help doesn't actually help. And here is where we really need to convey a much more hopeful view of dealing with mental health problems for young people. Clearly, there's a lot we need to learn about mental health and the brain and ways to treat and effectively deal with mental disorders. And we have a long way to go. But we do have some very effective evidence-based treatments now. So we need to convey this message to young people that if they reach out for help, they will get helped. Young people also have concerns about confidentiality and telling adults, particularly in communities like school settings or perhaps a church setting or something where they're not sure that the adult that they might be talking to won't then go and tell other people. They are especially concerned about their peers finding out, though, much more so than about other adults finding out that they might have a problem. And this quote down here, I recall this young man very well, who was a 14-year-old boy who'd been receiving help for anxiety and depression. And he said that if his friends found out at age 14, he socially would be ruined. There was no way he could handle having his friends find out about that. He, incidentally, is he's a few years older now and received some very effective help, and it's made a huge difference to his life. But he was extremely concerned to keep this from his friends and the other kids at school. Young people also don't like talking to strangers, and they like to talk, I mean, most of us do, but young people in particular like to talk to people they know and people who they have a trusted relationship with, which is where those of us who work with them on a daily basis can come into our own, because we are the people who they are more comfortable talking with. This means, though, also that they do still rely on their family and friends. And family and friends are the people they're most likely to disclose to and share their issues with. This can even actually be a barrier, though, to seeking more qualified help, especially for some young people from particular cultural groups. There are some cultural and linguistically diverse groups where there's a very strong sense that you keep your problems within the family. You don't share them outside the family group. So this can be a particular cultural barrier for some young people seeking professional help. Many young people also don't know what to say. They're embarrassed about their inner world, their mental health problems, and they don't have a language by which they can convey what's going on for them. And we call this sort of emotional competence, being able to understand and articulate your own emotional world. But young people, and particularly some younger boys, really have trouble expressing what's going on for them in this domain. There's also a substantial group of young people who have had a negative past experience and have attempted to seek help before and not felt helped. And when that happens, you often, with young people, you get one window of opportunity when they reach out. If that wasn't effective for them, they then are very likely to shut down and not want to seek help again. Add this to knowing that the main problems that young people experience actually work against reaching out when you think about the main mental health problems that they experience. So depression, one of the main symptoms of depression is social withdrawal. People withdraw into themselves, they don't want to reach out and talk to other people. Anxiety, by its very nature, is characterised by fear, by embarrassment. You're worried about going to a stranger. You don't know what to say. Substance use is illegal, is illicit. You need to keep it hidden. Self-harm, people feel shameful about self-harming, so work very hard to keep it hidden. And the term help negation actually comes from work with suicide, where we find that the higher the level of suicidal ideation, the less likely young people are to actually seek professional help and reach out. And this makes sense. And in particular, young people then don't disclose that to their family, especially their mother. Both boys and girls are most likely to talk to their mother, but you're not likely to tell your mother who gave you life that you don't want your life anymore. So young people are protective then by not reaching out and telling their family and friends what's going on. So how do we intervene then if there's all these barriers that work against young people seeking help? And here we need to think about where young people are at in their lives and how their brain's working. So talk to them in ways that's going to connect. So there's no point trying to scare them and motivate them with consequences, rational consequences. If you do this, this will happen. If you don't do this, this will happen. They just shut down with those messages. You need to identify a need or a goal that's meaningful to them. And if you think back, this is about emotional arousal and also about peers. So finding a way that you can hook into that they either get some sort of something that makes them feel good emotionally, or it's going to make them feel better emotionally, or you use peer influence, so either they're going to be included or make them feel they belong more with their peers. It's also important not to wait for full-blown crises, but to get help early. And I'll have to go through all this pretty quickly, but here's some of the sort of wording that you might be able to use where you can start to use some of those messages. So by saying to a young person, you seem to be pretty down. Is that how you're feeling? Reflective listening. The main thing, the one thing that is essential, young people need to feel heard. You don't have to be the expert fixing everything, just genuinely listening and being with a young person and hearing them and reflecting that back to them is the one single thing that anybody can do best to help them. Here, you know, you can go on, use some social referencing. So other young people have found this important, that, you know, this is a way that you might be able to go. Many young people go through tough times, so how about trying some things that other young people have found helpful? In terms of responding to a crisis, and I'm going to have to move through this pretty quickly, you do need to remain calm, supportive, and especially non-judgmental, and have to be very careful about non-verbally, we often show how we feel, and particularly if you're seeing something like self-harm or engaging in risky behaviour, we need to mask how, you know, if we're shocked or horrified. Really, young people are acutely attuned to finding out that how you're judging them. They really don't like to feel judged, and the other thing is they really want to be listened to. Another important thing is this point four here. Don't, when you're talking with a young person who you think is experiencing problems, don't let out your inner Freud, your frustrated psychoanalyst who might be inside. Unless you're actually trained in those skills, just keep it to having a genuine relationship and listening with the young person. Don't start trying to psychoanalyze, because if you start looking for meaning, you can actually unhinge somebody even more, which is what you don't want to do if somebody's come to you and disclosed. You want to get them to effective help and effective support, not have them unravel even more in front of you. You may need to make a risk assessment, and this is particularly important. Just work through quickly. Andrew's creeping up behind me, so I'll have to hurry. One of the main things I want to say is suicide. This is probably the crisis that we're most concerned about. But we used to be worried about, and particularly in schools, didn't mention the S word. But we now have good data showing it is okay to ask. And if you ask, people will generally tell you. They won't disclose it automatically, but if you ask them and you ask in the right way, people will tell you. You then need to know how acute the risk of suicide is, and you need to know how to respond to it. And there are some resources, some of this this Mythbuster on the Headspace site can help you how you work through that. We now know a lot about what young people want about services, have a lot of research around that, which brings me to the Headspace Services, which I work in now, which we have set up deliberately and funded by the Australian government as mental health services, specifically to cater for young people. And I think I saw many people at the Headspace desk, and the Headspace people, some of the Sydney people are here. You want to put your hand up? Are they here? They're up the back there. We're working up to having 90 Headspace centres across Australia, and New South Wales has, having one of the highest population groups, has, I think, has 22 centres. So we're coming up to 10 in Sydney. We also have eHeadspace, so young people can go online, which is a really good soft entry point for young people, and also Headspace School Support, which is a new service that especially helps school communities that have been affected or are concerned about a suicide in the school community. So my take-home message to you is those of us who are working with young people, we need to notice young people's behaviour and what's happening in their lives. We have an obligation to ask them, to reach out to them, ask them how they're going, and then to know what services, what are good youth-friendly services available in your area, including Headspace and eHeadspace and other online services that we can help young people get to the sort of help they need as early as they can so that we can intervene and help them through these teenage years. There's some also some other resources in your notes that you can follow up. So thank you very much.